KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Public Health Grand Rounds at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. I am Ruth Katz, Dean of the School, and we're delighted to have all of you here. This is the fourth session in our nine-part inaugural series, and as you can see and will see as more people come in, it has become a terrifically popular event here at the school and across the entire medical center. So popular, in fact, that we hope to make Public Health Grand Rounds an annual tradition here at the school. And whether you are with us for the first time today or have attended our earlier sessions, I can almost guarantee that you will find today's event well worth your time. Pfizer Inc. is providing the support that makes this program possible, and I'd like to express my personal gratitude again to the company. We certainly would not be here today if Pfizer had not made the commitment it has. The theme of our Grand Round series is Milestones in Public Health. That has a special resonance for us here at the school as we celebrate our own milestone this year, the 10th anniversary of our founding. But we also chose that theme to tie into a terrific traveling exhibit and a book of the same name, copies of which are available in the lobby, both produced by Pfizer. The Milestones in Public Health exhibit was on display here at the beginning of the semester and is now making its way around the country. This Grand Round series brings us renowned experts from many of the milestone fields to look at the progress we have made and at the unfinished agenda that still demands our attention. Julie Gerberding, Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, kicked off our program. Later, David Nabarro, a senior advisor from the World Health Organization, talked to us about infectious diseases. And Bernard Goldstein, former dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health and an expert in environmental health, took on the milestone of environmental health. Today, we will hear from Dr. Harold Freeman, an oncologist, an expert in health disparities, and senior advisor to the director of the National Cancer Institute. I reminded him when we first met just a couple, or re-met, I should say, just a little while ago, he would not remember me, but I certainly remember him. I actually first met Dr. Freeman almost 20 years ago when I was counsel to Congressman Henry Waxman's health subcommittee in the early 1990s. He testified before that committee, and I remember quite vividly his careful and thought-provoking testimony back then, and I am certain, absolutely certain, that he will be equally engaging today as he explores the milestone of cancer. One of the things you can expect to hear from Dr. Freeman, and indeed from all of our distinguished speakers, is passion and the conviction that a strong public health infrastructure is essential to a healthy society. That is a fundamental belief at this school, and one reason why we invite students and faculty in all the fields of study and the general public as well to each of our Grand Round series. I hope you will join us for as many of the remaining sessions as you can. Our next event is scheduled for January 16th. Our speaker then will be Dr. Walter Ornstein, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Associate Director of Emory University's Vaccine Center, as well as Director of the Emory Program for Vaccine Policy and Development. Dr. Ornstein will discuss the milestone of, very, very good, you're paying attention. More information about the Grand Round Series is available on the school's website. And by the way, if you miss any of these events, you need not miss their content. Thanks to the generosity of the Kaiser Family Foundation, we are able to both webcast and podcast the entire series, allowing for a much broader audience to participate. And now it's my great pleasure to turn the podium over to Dr. John F. Williams to tell you more about Dr. Freeman. Dr. Williams is Provost and Vice President for Health Affairs here at GW. His strong and effective leadership in both capacities has been crucial in guiding the university's diverse educational and research agendas. Dr. Williams has been a real friend to the School of Public Health and Health Services since it was established 10 years ago. I'm sure that reflects at least in part the fact that he holds degrees in both medicine, and we are most proud, in public health as well. Joining us here today is just one more demonstration of his wholehearted support for our mission. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. John Williams.
Thank you.
And at the end of this, will someone explain to me what a webcast and a podcast, what's the difference? I'm a little confused on that. But good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. It is indeed a great pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Harold Freeman. Dr. Freeman is truly one of the pioneers in public health and cancer in particular. As you can see, he is a senior advisor to the director of the National Cancer Institute of the NIH. He is also a professor of surgery at Columbia University. He has had a long, distinguished career. For 25 years, Dr. Freeman was director of surgery at Harlem Hospital in New York. And for a two-year period ending in 2001, he also served as the president and CEO of North General Hospital in New York. He is a diplomat of the American Board of Surgery and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. He has been medical director of the Breast Examination Center in Harlem, a program of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center since 1979. Dr. Freeman was also elected to membership in the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences in 1997. He served as national president of the American Cancer Society from 1988 to 89, and he is the chief architect of the American Cancer Society's initiative of Cancer in the Poor, and is a leading authority on the interrelationships between race, poverty, and cancer. The Society, in his honor, established the Harold P. Freeman Award in 1990 to recognize his work in this area. This award is presented annually by the American Cancer Society's divisions throughout the United States to individuals who have made outstanding contributions to the fight against cancer in the poor. Dr. Freeman pioneered the Patient Navigation Program, which addresses disparities in access to treatment, particularly among poor and uninsured. This program is designed to assist medically underserved patients in navigating their way through a complex health system by overcoming barriers to timely diagnosis and treatment of cancer. The success of Dr. Freeman's Patient Navigator program has led many other health care organizations to adopt similar initiatives. Based on this model, the Patient Navigator and Chronic Disease Prevention Act was signed into law by President Bush in June 2005. Dr. Freeman is the past chairman of the President's Cancer Panel, to which he was appointed to four consecutive three-year terms, first by President Bush in 1991, and subsequently by President Clinton in 1994, 1997, and 2000. He is a recipient of numerous honorary degrees, as well as virtually every named cancer award. He is also a recipient of the George Washington University Cancer Institute's Distinguished Public Service Award. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Dr. Harold Freeman.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Dr. Williams, Dr. Katz. I do remember very well, Dr. Katz, that time in the perhaps 1990 or so when I did testify before the committee, and I do remember you well, and you remember me too. Thank you so much. It's a privilege to speak here today, and the things I'm going to speak about are very complex, and I'm going to paint a very broad brush in describing these issues, and it would take much more time to filter down to various elements of this. As you can see from the title, I'm going to talk about poverty, and poverty is a universal force that affects anyone who is poor, irrespective of race. I'm going to talk about the effect of culture, which has to do with behavior, belief systems, and values. That is a very important determinant of how people survive and if people survive. And I'm going to talk about inequities in our society that are very important in driving disparities. So this is a different approach to the subject from the typical way we approach disparities in the biomedical community. And I'm going to give you some ideas that you may debate, and you may believe. Let me move. How do I control the? Tell me how to do. Okay, now I got it. I've got it. Okay. Okay. Now, let's start with this. In December of 1991, a president of the United States, Richard Nixon, declared a war against cancer. And here's a picture of the president signing the National Cancer Act, which was the Declaration of War Against Cancer in 1971. Now, I'm going to talk about this because I think it was a wonderful thing that a president would sign a National Cancer Act, and it did bring a lot more resources to cancer research. But I'm going to also talk about the problems surrounding the way the war was declared and how it's been fought. Because the issue is, how big is the war? What is the terrain on which the war should be fought? And we're going to discuss that. To introduce my talk, I have two slides that will set forth my own paradigms of thinking about the issues of disparities. And here's the first, and I'll show you the second in a minute. I believe that there are three major driving forces of disparities, and they are whether people have resources or not, the poverty, low economic status circle that you see before you, how people behave, the culture circle, values, belief systems, worldview, behavior, lifestyle, the cultural circle, and finally, whether or not people have been treated fairly over time, the social justice or injustice circle. I'm going to suggest to you that these are the three major driving forces of disparities, and that these three forces overlap and synergize each other, and also the relative effects of one of these circles changes over time. I'm going to argue that these three circles of determinants drive what happens all the way from prevention on the far left through detection, diagnosis, treatment, survival, and death. I'm going to suggest also that it is conceivable that these three factors influence the gene-environment interaction. For example, if people live in a poor community where there's a toxic environment, what is the effect on the genetics of those people? And so this is just an example of how there may be a gene-environment interaction related to a factor such as poverty and exposures that people get because they don't have resources, or behavior would be another factor like that. So let me put that forth as a major thought, and we're going to examine elements of these three circles as we go forward. Let me also introduce to you another paradigm that I would put forth for your debate, and you don't have to necessarily believe this. This is the way I'm thinking of this at this point. Our approach to these other three circles have to be defined. Clearly, we could approach the disparities issues through biomedical science. And I think, look at the NCI budget, which is $5 billion a year, that budget is primarily being placed and biomedical science research. But there are other kinds of science that perhaps we don't stress as much. There's the social sciences, such as sociology, anthropology, there's economics, there's psychology. So there are social sciences that bring something to the plate, too, that have to do with disparities. Sociologists, for example, study people as they live in their various neighborhoods and elements such as that. But yet, today, in my opinion, there's not much of an exchange of ideas between the biomedical sciences and the social sciences. I suggest that maybe we should stimulate that kind of exchange. Let me add a third element, civil and human rights. At the heart of disparities, I believe, is the matter of inequity. And we can define inequity in many different ways. Inequity related to race, social status, age, or any other factors that you could examine. But I don't think we think of Sparity's approach, combining these three things together, which I suggest overlap and drive the problem as well. So if I presented this well, I'm saying that we're dealing with poverty, culture, and social injustice as determinants of disparities. And I'm suggesting that at least as part of the solution, we should think of the marriage between biomedical science and social science, as well as history, and combining these two approaches to human rights. There have been a number of landmark studies that have been produced. I will not name all these studies. Here's a picture for you over time. The first major report in the literature was from Howard University on disparities, black and white differences. And that report was written by Hensky and LaFall, and it indicated that looking at data that was available to anyone at that time, there'd been an alarming increase in death from cancer for black Americans in the previous 25 years compared to white Americans. And that study came out in the early 70s. So that was the first study that began to really focus the nation on the disparities issues. In the 1980s, I led some studies that had an effect. We began to look at the effect of poverty on cancer, as well as race and poverty together, because it always occurred to me, in my own personal experience, in a community of poor black people, that I didn't really understand the interrelationship between the point that the people I was treating at Harlem Hospital were coming in late and dying early. They were all black, but they also were all poor. And as a young surgeon in the late 1960s, I began to try to disentangle in my own thinking the meaning of being black in America at that time, and also the meaning of being poor. What was driving the disparity? Could it be the poverty was overwhelming it, or was it race? Or was it some interrelationship between poverty and race? I began to ask those questions of myself at a very early part of my career. And I got promoted to national offices that allowed me to look at these issues from a national perspective, and that's what drove my career. So for the young people in the audience, look at the situation you're in. Ask the right questions. Go deeper into those questions. The answers may be right before you. Just look for those answers. And that's what I attempted to do at that time. So my career has been driven by a person, person being myself, who trained to a high level as a cancer surgeon, who chose to go to a poor black community to practice, who began to see people coming in with very late cancer and dying of late cancer of the diseases, and it raised questions of what was driving this, and that's the personal perspective. Now, survival is a kind of a fundamental instinct that's seen in all biological forms, and man is no exception. But the social, political, and economic environment in which people live determines whether people will survive and the quality of that survival. So that's a very fundamental point. So as we go to study diseases, it's important to understand the molecular elements of disease and all the other things that you study. But I don't think we've studied disease sufficiently unless we study the conditions in which people live that may drive disparities. Here's a big finding, life expectancy at birth according to race. And you can see that sex matters and race matters. Women live longer than men in general, and black people don't live as long as white people, male or female. So this, if you're going to look at disparities, perhaps the most robust measure of disparities is who dies too soon. And I would take that as the thing that drives my definition of disparities. looking at cancer death rates in particular, you can see that African-American males have by far the highest death rate compared to any other group, and next, African-American females. So if you're looking at race and looking at a big, large data, then being black becomes somewhat of a risk factor according to these results. The question is why. Another element to look at with respect to disparities is geography. And here's a very important study produced by the National Cancer Institute along with the SEER data, which shows that in the blue in each racial ethnic group depicted here, you'll see that the blue represents census tract communities that have less than 10% poverty. And in each group, the people in the blue have the best results. The red or pink orange on this chart represents communities that have 20% or higher poverty. And in each group, whether it's all races, white, black, Asian, or Hispanic, the poorer people are, the worse they do with respect to cancer mortality. An interesting point here, if you look at the far three bars, which is Hispanic, there's something we call the Hispanic paradox, because Hispanic people seem to do better with respect to outcome with cancer and even other diseases than you would expect from their poverty level. For example, the orange on the far side of Hispanic, which represents the poorest community for Hispanic, do better than the middle community and the black community. So something, whatever Hispanic means, is driving something that is different that we need to understand. We call it the Hispanic paradox. But still, within being Hispanic in this country, the poorer you are, the worse you do within being among Hispanic people. So geography does matter, and that's another factor we need to look at. Here's another example of geography, and here again, data is available for researchers to look at. At the county level in America, we know incidence, mortality, survival of every cancer at the county level. This is fairly new. At the National Cancer Institute, we picked cervical cancer to look at to see what was the result geographically in cervical cancer outcome, mortality. And here's a map that deals with white females and cervical cancer. The worst results are in the purple. You see some purple in parts of this slide, and this is at the county level, looking at American white women, death rate from cervical cancer. And we picked this because no one in America should die of cervical cancer at this point. No one, not anyone should die. So the fact that nearly 4,000 women die every year from cervical cancer is unacceptable. And it's even more telling to see that people are dying of a disease from which no one should die in certain communities that can be delineated. And this, I think, is an important point, because if you know where people are dying from what, it may give you some opportunity to direct special resources to those geographic areas, which is different from a national approach that would approach, say, for example, the point that there are 46 million uninsured American people, and that's not acceptable. So the approaches that could be taken nationally to fight disparities issues, and the approaches that we could take locally. We'll go a little more deeper into that later. Look at black American females. And look at the amount of purple in this slide, just as a gross indicator. The purple, as you can see, on the scale, is the highest mortality rate. And here you see a lot more purple than you saw on the slide for American white women. It kind of suggests that race and poverty have an effect. We need to figure out what is the synergism. But it looks to me that all of the women who are dying from cervical cancer, whether they're white or black, are poor for the most part. There's some exceptions. But it also appears that being black and poor is a factor that is And it's just something to think about. In my own personal experience, in Harlem, in 1990, a colleague and I wrote a paper which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1990. My colleague, Dr. McCord, had spent time in Bangladesh in public health. He had the Bangladesh statistics. We decided to look at Harlem and compare Harlem to Bangladesh and came up with a very striking conclusion. That is that a black male in Harlem in 1990 had less of a chance of reaching age 65 than a male in Bangladesh. This struck the whole nation and the world as something that was somewhat incredible, but what it really meant, and still means today. And Harlem is a metaphor. It's not just one community, there are many Harlems throughout America and the world. It means that we have third world communities within the first world. Another reflection of what geography could mean with respect to targeting resources. Black men in Harlem, dying at a higher rate than males in Bangladesh. I visited China in 1989. That year, I was the national president of the American Cancer Society. A lecturer there who was Chinese brought out this idea. In the Chinese language, the same word that means crisis also means opportunity. The same word. What I learned from that is a philosophical approach. So if you have a crisis, the Chinese say, you also have an opportunity. But you have to find what the opportunity is. After you define what the crisis is, it opens up possible ways to solve the crisis. And these are the Chinese characters that I'm told mean that. I'm not sure about that because I can't in Chinese. Now, let me go forward with three major questions. And remember, I'm painting with a very, very broad brush here. There's not enough time to filter down on great details, but I want to leave you with some things to at least think about. So there are three major questions I'm going to raise and in part answer. The first question is, what are the causes of disparities in cancer survival? I've introduced a slide to suggest what I believe they are. The second question is race a determinant of how people are treated? And the third question, reflecting back on the slide that I showed with Nixon signing the National Cancer Act, how can we fight a successful war on cancer? I'm going to try to answer those three questions briefly. The first question, what are the causes of disparities in cancer survival? Now, let me point out, as I've implied before, that diseases of any type, cancer and other diseases, occur in the context of human circumstances. And if we don't understand the human circumstances in which diseases occur, we don't understand the disease. It certainly is necessary to understand the science of disease, but that's not enough. It's not enough to understand molecules. You need to understand people. And here's another thought, and it reflects back on the Declaration of the War Against Cancer in 1971 by Richard Nixon. That declaration supported the discovery enterprise in America, particularly at the NCI, which was very important. Please don't get me wrong, that was an important thing to do and a great contribution. But I had noticed that in America, we had fought wars before, and we fought a war against the Nazis, we fought a war, several other wars we could name. But we don't always fight the wars that should be fought, but we do fight wars in a certain way. And I noticed in the wars that we fought militarily, we discovered the weapons to use to fight the war, the armamentarium, and then we would apply the armaments in the area where the enemy was invading. That seemed to be a principle of military war. I suggest We haven't done that so well in cancer. We have a rather good discovery enterprise, which needs to be supported even more than it is. But there's a real disconnect, I think, between what we discover as a nation and what we deliver to the American people. Disconnect between what we know and what we do. I suggest that this is a critical determinant of disparities, because if we applied what we know to all people, irrespective of their ability to pay, or whether it's short, or whether it's black, or white, or anything else, this would close the gap considerably. Wouldn't close it entirely. But so I cite this as a huge part of the problem. The discovery-delivery disconnect. And let me define what I mean by delivery. Because when I speak of delivery, I'm not talking just about delivery of care to people, which is a very important thing to deliver. I'm talking about delivery of information and care. Because part of delivery has to be to educate people about how they can protect themselves. All American people need to become foot soldiers in the war against cancer, a war to save their own lives through behavioral change. And so my delivery concept is the concept that involves education and access to care, operating again against a whole spectrum of what happens to people, from prevention, detection, survival, and death. Reminding you of the three circles that I've already painted the picture of, causes of health disparities. And now let's talk about the issue of poverty. And we don't have long to talk and to give a talk only about poverty. It's a huge issue. First of all, as I've said before, poverty doesn't care what race you're in. Poverty will treat you like you're poor. It doesn't care about race. You're poor, you're going to have certain circumstances. Those circumstances include, but are not limited to, poor living conditions, substandard housing. Poor people tend to have less knowledge and information. Poor people tend to have a risk-promoting lifestyle, but not always true. And poor people clearly have a diminished access to health care. So this is what poverty means in the paradigm that I'm painting here. So if this is true, then it means that you really can't separate diminished access to health care from poor housing or poor education. So we're medical people, we're scientific people, we tend to do what we know. But I'm going to remind all of us to think outside of the box that we're in with respect to the disciplines that we're in and doing, whether a surgeon in my case or anything else, because what we do is not truly separated from the rest of the world. So if you're poor, you have low access to health care, but you also have poor living conditions. And I don't believe you can truly solve the issue of poverty unless you look at what poverty really means. Now, with respect to race, you can see that black and Hispanic people have higher poverty rates. Black and Hispanic people have lower insurance rates. Hispanic people, a third of Hispanic people in America have no health insurance, compared to 20% of black Americans and 11% of white Americans. So this is an issue we need to understand. However, and paint it this way, but the 11% of white people who are uninsured are just as uninsured as the 32% of Hispanic people. So one, we can look at it according to race, or we can look at what is the condition in and of itself. And I think we need to look at it both ways. And here again, to illustrate the interrelationships that we believe occur between poverty, culture, and survival, poverty then drives negative events that are pictured in these boxes, such as inadequate physical and social environment, lack of information, tendency to risk-promoting lifestyle, diminished access to health care. Where does culture come into this picture? Perhaps, culture becomes a prism through which poverty operates. If this is true, then culture has the opportunity to either diminish or accentuate poverty's expected negative effects. An example. The Seventh-day Adventists are a group of people who, according to their religion, have a certain lifestyle. If you are a Seventh-day Adventist, I've visited with these people, and I'm very fascinated by their lifestyle. If you're a true Seventh-day Adventist, you don't smoke cigarettes, you don't drink alcohol, and you're close to being a vegetarian. Well, it happens that that means even if you're poor, this strong cultural background and behavioral factor is going to drive you to survive. You don't smoke, you don't drink, eat vegetables. As a matter of fact, the real fact of the matter is that in studying different groups of people in the country, the people who have the highest life expectancy and the lowest cancer death rate are the Seventh-day Adventists. I'm not here to convert you to a religion, but I think there's something to be learned about that. There's something to be learned. So here's a case where culture even overwhelms poverty, in a sense, with respect to outcome. Well, take the people in Harlem that I've worked with for now 40 years, and things have improved over those 40 years, but these are people who are black and poor, smoke heavier than others, drink heavier than others, and the staple food is something that you may not have heard of, but it's called soul food in Harlem. High in fat, high in salt. So it's not a really good diet. So I went to visit Appalachia, too, at a certain point. I found the same kind of lifestyle there in Harlem. Harlan, Kentucky, very similar to Harlem, New York, with respect to lifestyle. Harlan, Harlem. Rolls. Tripping off of my tongue to say those two together. So, black and white, same attitudes, same health practices, high death rate. So it was a revelation to me in those early days when I saw the people in Appalachia very similar to the people in Harlem with respect to lifestyle and having the same problems. So culture is a very important issue. Let's go to another factor, and that is race. We said we'll talk about race. And we don't have a long time to talk about race here today, but let's put it on the table. Race, I suggest, is perhaps the single most defining issue in the history of America. And let me tell you why. Depicted here is about 500 years of American history. Going back to 1492 with the discovery of America, discovery, and quotes about Columbus, because it's kind of hard for me to understand how you can discover a country with people already in it. But it's always bothered me a little bit. But let's say the history books said Columbus discovered America. I suggest that Columbus was discovered in America by the people who were already here. Then we had slavery, introduced in 1619, first slaves. A wonderful history, Declaration of Independence, 1776. Thomas Jefferson wrote the beautiful document. A complicated man, very complicated man, to write such a document and at the same time have more than 100 slaves himself. Civil War, we fought a civil war for 4 years in this country, and it was driven by the slavery problem. Emancipation, Reconstruction, 14th Amendment. All men are equal by 1866. Plessy versus Ferguson reversed that. Homer Plessy put on a train to test whether blacks could be on a certain part of a train. They put him off the train. He was taken to the Supreme Court, and Plessy versus Ferguson is Plessy the complainant who was an octoroon by the standard 1/8. Black, 7/8 white. He argued he should have been considered white. Tough argument. He lost the case. Brown decision, 1954, civil rights movement, 1960s, leading up to the current time when we're still debating the race issues with the Michigan decision, and perhaps some reversal could occur in the Supreme Court case being heard right now. This is American history. So race is a very important issue in American history, and it's a determinant of what has happened to people. What I think it means is that in this nation, with this background, we tend to see people through the lens of race, and then we tend to value and behave toward one another through this powerful lens of race. Whereas it would be more ideal if we would see people as people first, and then think of how people might be hyphenated at a lower level of concern. That's what I'd like to see happen. At this point, we do see and value each other and behave toward each other according to race. And the problem with that is that if you see somebody and you classify them in your mind as you're in a certain race, whether or not you intend harm, and I don't think meaning intending harm is the American problem at this point, the problem is that we tend to see people at all through this lens, as opposed to looking at human beings, which we should be looking at. And the problem is, then, what assumptions do you make when you see somebody and put them in a certain classification? What assumptions do you make? We're going to visit that a little bit more. False assumptions can be created, even when not intending harm. The IOM report in 2003 sort of brought this out, that race matters as a determinant of how people get treated for cancer, even at the same economic status and same insurance level. So that report was very recent, brought this out. Now, it's hardly true. I just know that doctors don't make exceptions about, you know, race in general with respect to how they treat people. But the question is, what assumptions do we even as physicians make about people according to race? Do we make decisions that have to do with, well, I don't believe this person is going to be compliant because they look and talk a certain way? Do we make those assumptions? Maybe. Could be true. So this paradigm is reflecting itself even into the field of medicine, and even the field of medicine where I suggest that no doctor is trying to mistreat anybody. But what are the assumptions? What does race mean genetically? Probably not much. How could it mean so much when the categories of race in America are determined by what part of government? The Office of the Management of the Budget. That's who determines the categories. So if you take that framework, and then clearly in the directive number 15 of the OMB on race, they say these categories have nothing to do with biology or anthropology. But if you take the same categories and put them into science at the NIH, which we do, what does that mean? And then you begin to make studies on polymorphisms according to race. What does it mean? You've taken a false set of categories and put them into science. There's some dangers to that, and perhaps there's some things that make sense about that. We'll go a little further. We're racialized as a country. We don't have time to go deep into this either. But people were not biologically in races. We were put into races by a historical process that we can call racialization. And we go through this process, make assumptions about categories of race, and then put it into science, scientific assumptions, and circulate it in science. You already have built in false assumptions into science, as I suggest. And yet there are arguments about why we can't give up the racial categories because there are inequities that need to be measured. Very, very complex, very complex. So race is a determinant of how people are treated, I've already implied. Let me give you some examples of that. Peter Bach, a colleague, in 1999, published an important paper showing that race mattered as a determinant of who got the curative treatment for lung cancer, which was early stage. And it mattered to the point that there was 12% 12.7 percentage points lower for black people getting the curative treatment, having corrected for insurance and economic status. So something happening here, and it reflected itself into the survival. The same research in 2005 pointed out another point, that 80% of black patients receive care from one-fifth of all physicians, that black patients in the country in general are less likely to have access to board-certified specialists, and that black patients in general, he concluded, face obstacles in accessing tertiary treatment. So this is a factor that has to be weighed. It's all a factor of race and how people see each other through the lens of race, or is it that how people are geographically placed in America cannot get care? This is something we have to have a serious dialogue about. An interesting study by Ayanian on who gets transplanted kidneys. And he looked at it very scientifically, and I'll go quickly through this. This slide illustrates patients who wanted to have transplantation, and the differences in race are not marked at all. What about the people who really had access to transplantation, patients who really wanted transplantation? The referral pattern much lower in blacks, and the wait list much higher in blacks. And these were people who had been corrected for insurance and other factors. So something going on here that we need to put on the table. Race matters as a determinant of how people get treated. Who gets treated for pain, race matters. Now going to the last part of my talk, related to time, I'm going to move very rapidly now. The question is, how can we fight a successful war against cancer? We say the president declared a war against cancer. It was a research war. He didn't connect the research to delivery of care, and that's a huge American problem. The first thing that I would suggest that we need to do as a society is to apply whatever we know at any given time to all American people, irrespective of their ability to pay. That's the first and major suggestion. That's how the war, I think, should be fought. The second point that I would make is that it's not acceptable that we have 46 million uninsured American people and growing. We have 35 million additional American people who are underinsured if they have a strong enough test for being treated for a disease that's complex like cancer. They will find that they are not insured enough to pay for their care. Totally unacceptable. We need to provide universal access to health care for all American people. A third major point. I've given you information about geography. I suggest this. We've had tsunami, we've had Katrina. It's pointed out the point that there are natural disasters that occur in this world that should direct how we target our resources. We didn't do so well with Katrina, but at least raised the point. I suggest that in healthcare, we need to delineate geographical and cultural areas of extreme excess mortality in America, such as the Harlem paper that we pointed out in 1990. And we need to not only delineate, we need to provide special resources to these areas of excess mortality, as is commonly done in natural disaster areas, with the exception of Katrina, that wasn't done so well. Specifically, we need to target such areas with intense education, culturally relevant, control of tobacco, and access to early diagnosis and treatment of the support. We need to, in addition, create a high level of awareness among medical trainees and professionals regarding their role in eliminating bias in medical care to the extent that that occurs. We shouldn't stop with educating professionals. We should monitor what happens. It's not enough to educate. Cultural sensitivity is a wonderful thing, but we have no checks on what is really happening. As results, you probably won't correct the situation. This happened in the civil rights movement. Monitors were placed. So you say you're doing the right thing, but what are the results? So we need to monitor in this area as well. may have done something wrong. I need an expert. Take a 30-second break.
All right. I don't have page now. There you go.
Keep going. Keep going a little more. See my lecture flash through in retrospect. Okay. All right, here we go. Sorry. Okay. And here's something that may not be a popular thing to say, but I believe that every individual, regardless of economic status, needs to share in the responsibility of promoting his or her own health and well-being. People have to be responsible for their own lives to the extent that they can be responsible. And I want to discuss the issue of patient navigators, in particular something that I pioneered myself, and I want to say a word about it. In Harlem, we noted the problems of excess mortality. At a certain point in 1999, we created something called patient navigation, essentially assigning people from the community within the healthcare system to go one-on-one with people who came into the system and had a positive finding, such as an abnormal mammogram. And the job of the navigator is to resolve the case, no matter what it takes. Is it a matter of communication? Is it a matter of lack of insurance, transportation, whatever it is, fear? And so the patient navigators were brought into the picture. Operating from the point of finding through the point of resolution, primarily, and to go quickly to the point, before intervention with patient navigation and screening, we had a 39% 5-year survival rate with breast cancer at Harlem Hospital. After the intervention in both published studies, we have a 70% 5-year survival with breast cancer in Harlem, same hospital, people just as poor, just as uninsured, just as minority. We did something to change this. What we did was assure that it would get screened, that they had screening and had a finding, assure them that it would get resolved all the way through treatment. A simple set of principles, but it does work. Patient navigation. And here is the President of the United States signing the Patient Navigation Act on June 29, 2005 in the Oval Office. And you can see that he appears to be very happy on this particular day. I won't say much more about that. Very thankful the President would consider signing this into law. It's put $25 million on the plate, a small amount of money. But when a President signs something into law, it has a deep effect. People begin to pay attention, and that's what has happened. We believe there are some 300 patient navigation programs around the country, maybe more, doing different elements of navigation. And this thing is catching on fast. You have a program here at this center, for example. Some final thoughts. Going back to the Declaration of the War Against Cancer, 1971, December the 23rd, Richard Nixon, I would suggest that the war against cancer, having been declared, did have some benefits. But we didn't use our guns very well in the neighborhoods of America where people were having the worst problems, and we still are not. So we need to fight a war in the way we fight a military war. Apply the guns to where the enemy is invading. We need to connect our discovery system to our delivery system. What we know that should be applied for everyone, irrespective of who they are and whether they're insured or not. The unequal burden of disease in our society, I believe, is a challenge to science, but it's more than that. It's a moral and ethical dilemma for this nation. We see each other in this society according to race. We need to somehow begin to see each other as we are, which is human beings. The fact of the matter is that all 6.5 billion people in this planet, on this planet, are of African origin. If we could accept that, maybe we could solve this problem. Hard argument to make. That's the truth. I would like to connect the area of justice in the distribution of medical resources to the argument, to the paradigm. Poverty should not be an offense which is punishable by death. It's just not right. Shouldn't let that happen in this country. And here's the paradigm I'm going to suggest again, that we should certainly continue to stress the paradigm of biomedical science. The war against cancer, the billions of dollars have been spent in this circle primarily so far. But there are social sciences, there are anthropologists and historians and sociologists and others who can contribute to our knowledge of disparities, and we should have greater discussion between biomedical science and social science. And we need to overlay this with concern for injustice and human rights, which is a higher level than civil rights. Human rights more important than civil rights. And so this is the paradigm that I would recommend, the new paradigm, because these three circles so far are separated in this great nation. We need to create a dialogue across these areas, because inequity is driving disparities more than anything else. Inequity is seen clearly in the civil and human rights circle more than in any way. And finally, the great civil rights leader, Martin Luther King, said this: of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and inhumane. And I'll end with a comment of a scientist whom I respect the most, Albert Einstein, who and his theories of relativity determine that what you see depends on where you stand. As an example, if a bolt of lightning struck in the middle of Washington, D.C., and if Dr. Williams was standing in the south, I'm standing in the north, we would see this event differently from our perspective, and it would be accurate from our perspective. What you see depends on where you stand. But Einstein also proved that there is a constant in nature. The speed of light moves at 186,000 miles per second. There's always something to use as a monitor for everything else, a constant. We look for constants while we see things from different perspectives. Perhaps the greatest constant for our nation is the Declaration of Independence itself, that all men are created equal. And perhaps we would use that as the speed of light for this nation, we'd be much better off. Thank you very much. I say this, that obesity is now, in recent studies from the CDC and others, been shown as a contributor to as high as 20% of cancers related to obesity, and that's just one disease. People in America are fatter than they've ever been. If you look at the maps from CDC, which has shown decade by decade, obesity rate is increasing. And it's having a deep effect on longevity of the American public. Certainly, your diet becomes a critical issue in that. In New York City, for example, there's the Commissioner of Health in New York City is trying to pass, it may not be successful, a law for the restaurants to reduce trans fats, to eliminate trans fats from all restaurants. So some things are happening around America. But I do believe that the issue of diet is very critical to health. It's something we cannot legislate, I don't think, very well. But it's a matter of training young people to adhere to certain diets. That's the best that we can do, beginning in the school system. Begin to train young people about the right diet, beginning in the homes of America. So it's a very important point. I suggest that if you can control your mouth, you can control your life. because if you can control your mouth, you wouldn't smoke, you'd eat the right foods, and then it gets into sexual activity as well, things that could occur. So I think that you raise a very important point.
Comment on the issue of provider bias, physician bias, and I'm thinking specifically about the ways we educate and train our recently a publication came out looking at provider activities and practices prescribing HIV medication to active substances. And the study looked at whether providers prescribed antiretroviral therapy differently based on race. They found, in fact, that medical providers were more likely to provide ARV or antiretroviral treatment to active substance users who are white, less likely who are black. Interesting thing to me, although that was very important, was that it didn't matter of race provider. Black provider, as well as a white provider, were more likely to provide treatment. Seems to point to me that there is something within our education system that actually may be apparently promoting racial bias.
It's a very interesting point. Let me point out, too, that not many days ago in New York City, a man was killed by a policeman on his wedding day. You probably read this in the newspaper. The interesting point about it, though, is that two of the policemen who shot him were black. And so it raised part of the point you're making is, are there cultural things that are happening that have to do not only with whether people are white providers, but whether there's a culture of providing to people as you see people through the lens of race? Well, you know, I think we have a very long way to go on this. There's hardly any doubt that this is true. There's so many proven examples that race matters as a determinant of how people get treated. It's newer information to suggest that the race of the provider may not be the major difference. That's somewhat newer information. So this is why I believe that the only way to get around this is certainly we should do the cultural sensitivity activities that we all do in all of our institutions, and that could pay off to a certain extent. But nothing will matter as much as monitoring outcome. I mean, sometimes people are doing the wrong thing and don't know they're doing the wrong thing. I mean, if you tell people you're not culturally sensitive, and it makes it, well, certainly I am, and maybe they think they are, but what they're actually doing is the point. So I don't believe there's anything that we can do that outweighs the point of picking some parameters to monitor, and then if it could come to grand rounds discussion to say this group of people did not receive this care as much as others, then we can begin to make the point. So it's the issue of cultural sensitivity and education, which I think is important. But don't stop there any more than we stopped there in the civil rights movement for the states in the South in particular. When they began to be monitored and some penalties were placed, that's when the behavior began to change. So that the monitoring is the key to me.
Dr. Frank, Freeman, I teach a course here regarding health policy and practice, and I was very happy to hear you mention the patient navigator legislation as our class looked at policy interventions that might be successful and shown to be successful. My question is, what do you think is the chance of having the patient navigator legislation and really that model
It's conceivable that it could happen. I'll tell you why. There are now three government agencies that are providing money for patient navigation sites to be set up. One is the Patient Navigation Act from the president, which gives $25 million through HRSA. That's beginning to percolate. It hasn't started yet. Another is $25 million over 5 years given from the National Cancer Institute to set up patient navigation programs. There are nine of them around the country. One of them is here in this very facility, one of those nine. And there's a third one, which may turn out to be the most important one of the three. Another $25 million has been assigned by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. This is serious because if they set up sites around the country and it proves to be cost-effective and beneficial, that will be the one that will lead to the greatest chance, I think, of it being putting it into Medicare and Medicaid. So right now, $75 million being put by government from those three agencies, it has to be $25 million, adding up to $75 million. That is a strong test of money, not a lot of money, for the nation to try to show whether these programs work or not. In addition to that, the American Cancer Society, the Komen Foundation, and other Avon and others are supporting this effort around the country. So I think it's a pretty dramatic thing that an idea that began in 1990 in Harlem created a model that by 2006 is supported by three agencies of government and much of the private community. And I think that my prediction is that this is going to, at a certain point, be adopted into the healthcare system. And the reason I say that is not because it does so much good for people, which it does, but I believe it even saves money. And that's how decisions are made in healthcare, when money is saved.
One more.
Alan, you and I have had this discussion many times. You articulate so well the gap between discovery and delivery, and how we need to fix that gap or stop it, but it's actually widening. And the pace of discovery and development of molecularly targeted therapeutics is racing ahead of our ability to deliver those therapeutics in equitable fashion. I wonder if you might comment.
One of the penalties of scientific advance is that the more you advance, the greater the gap you create. Because as you go forward, now we're getting into targeting treatments on a molecular level for cancer, which you know very well, because that's the field that you're in. So the advances in science always are going to be advances that the people who can afford it can get the highest advance. This is the way the capitalistic system is set up. I'm not against capitalism, but this is the way it is. So there's this conflict between making progress, which we must do, and the idea that a leading edge of the progress, at least in the beginning of the progress, will be given only those who can afford what it is. So I don't think there's a really good answer for that, when particularly when medicine more and more is being treated as a commodity instead of an art. And I think we're in a society that has a lot of good points, and I don't think any of us want to move out of the society, but we're in a market-driven society. The market is very powerful, whether it's pharmaceutical industries or hospitals, there's a financial element, whether it's research, cutting edge cannot be afforded by everything. It's we're in a capitalist system. As long as we have a system in which the determinant of whether you will get care is whether you can pay for it or not, we're going to have this problem. So it's going to take a change in thinking of the American society to fix this problem. I would suggest that as the problem is moving up in society from the very poorest down into the middle class, there's a chance that we could change the political will by public outcry. As long as only the poorest people are complaining, it won't happen. But now it's moving up into society. We might be at a chance, a point now, as part of its solution to what you say, but not all, that corporate America, people who make automobiles, are now saying we can't compete with the Japanese because we have to pay for benefits for our people. So now you're getting interesting bed partners on the access issues, getting people from corporate America in the same bed with people who were advocates. This may be a healthy thing for change, but it won't ever solve the problem that you have asked a question about. That is that the cutting-edge treatment, there will always be a distinction about who can get the most cutting-edge treatment. On the other hand, most treatment that saves lives is not cutting edge. If we can provide the routine things, like everyone can get tested in the four areas of cancer that can be screened for, everyone with a finding will get treated rapidly and with good quality of care. And this will solve the major part of the disparities issue. We haven't gotten there yet. It's another thing to solve the target area, top-line treatment. We'll always have a society, I think, where paying for it will be very important.